Hello, everyone. Welcome to Computer Science E7. This is Lecture 11, Take 3, Color. And so last week, we finished talking about some digital cameras and specifically the sensors that are found inside of digital cameras. And we talked about how these sensors aren't very simple devices. There's a number of layers that are associated with them, and each of these layers does something very important, who in aggregate produce the image that we are used to seeing out of these digital cameras. And so one of the most important things that you might find at the very top of the sensor, so we have this diagram. We showed this diagram last week, but there was another layer that was on top of all of this stuff. Do you happen to remember what this layer was? Above the micro lens, above the color filter, above all of this stuff, there was something I said, it was the topmost layer on a sensor. And when you're looking at the sensor, what you're looking at is this thing and not the actual sensor itself. Any recollection what that item happened to be? Right, so it's the low-pass filter, right. So basically what this, or this anti-alias filter is another word for it, and it's basically just the filter that's placed on top of all of this stuff, and it just makes the image a little bit softer, just ever so slightly, with the intention, because as you might recall, when we do some demosaicing with the color filter array, we can get some weird artifacts as a result, and so this makes everything much smoother so that we don't have those artifacts. Now, below that layer, in the typical sensor, we would have this bulbousy thing right here, which is a micro lens. And there's one micro lens on top of every pixel, and the job of this micro lens is to funnel or to channel all of the light that shines on the area of a pixel down into the one portion of the pixel that actually detects the light, or the photodiode, the actual portion of the pixel that actually detects the light, which is, of course, a smaller percentage of the actual pixel area, because there's other electronics just sort of cluttering the entire pixel area. So we can capture as much light as possible by using a lens to focus it down into this aspect. Now, before we actually hit the photodiode itself, we pass through the color filter array. And the color filter array, as you know, filters out other colors so that our photodiode or our pixel only detects one color. So the relative intensity of green, for example, or the relative intensity of blue or red. But no one pixel in a typical sensor can detect all colors all at the same time. So when we have this color filter array, we have three different colors, as you know, that are sort of the primary colors in computer land, and we arrange them into different arrays so that we can recombine them later to form the original color. And so the most typical type of color filter array that you would see is the Bayer color filter array, which looks like this, which is basically, you might see these twisted, you know, 90 degrees or 180 degrees, but basically the pattern is blue, green, green, red, like that. And so we have, again, an overabundance of green just because that happens to be the color that's most responsible for the luminance, for what our eyes appear, or what our eyes tell us is brightness. And so we having some additional data in this case makes the quality of the images a bit better. And we talked about how when we split apart each of these colors into multiple colors, because we have to record different colors at each pixel, we have to later recombine them through a process that we called demosaicing. And so we have to somehow recombine. We take four pixels and we look at the relative intensities of each and we determine, okay, well, there's a lot of green in this pixel and there's a lot of blue, but there's not a lot of red. So maybe this is some sort of a cyan color that we have in this at this location. And we do that to recombine all of the original pixels, or almost all of the original pixels that made up that scene that we saw in our sensor. Of course, we can't actually get all of the color because right at the edge, we can only find two, we only have these two pixels right here. So we can't somehow make up whatever color was represented by red on this end. So basically, we have fewer pixels in our output image than we have pixels on our sensor. And so this tells us why we have that difference in marketing materials that says, oh, we have an effective number of pixels versus an actual number of pixels on a sensor. Now, another thing we talked about was a competing technology called the foveon sensor, and how it's an interesting technology just because it behaves very differently, and it allows us to capture all of the color information at a single pixel location. It's not that one pixel can detect all colors, it's that we have we have n in one pixel, three different sensors that each are responsible for picking up the same color information. And so we don't have to perform this same deomosaicing algorithm just because we have all of the color information available to us right there. But there are, of course, some downsides to this as well, in that we might get some additional noise or chromatic noise in some pixels, that these sensors are just not developed as quickly as some of the other, as some of the Bayer type sensors that we have. Now, I mentioned last week that we showed some comparison between some of the Foveon sensor compared to a Canon 5D, and I did a little bit of research afterwards last week and found out that they're actually releasing a new camera that's based on this Foveon sensor, which is nice because there is still some competition coming from this competing sensor format. And this is actually supposed to be a very, very large megapixel camera. So it's supposed to be that there's about, 16 or 15 million pixels on the sensor itself. But they say that, okay, well, it's actually, because every pixel has three sensors, it's the equivalent of being 46 or 45 megapixels worth of information. Because, as you might recall, in a Bayer sensor, what they do is they have each of these pixels, they only detect one color, and they still call all of these pixels to be individual pixels so that they can multiply it together and say, okay, yeah, you have 3,000 pixels across, 2,000 pixels down. That means that you have a 6-megapixel sensor. But it's sort of disingenuous in a way, just because not all of those pixel locations can detect all color information. So they're sort of using that same idea and cheating a little bit and saying that their sensor is the equivalent of 45, 46 megapixels, which is ridiculous, frankly. It's a ridiculous amount of information that's available. So this will be interesting to see when this camera is actually released, which I think will be early next year. It will be interesting to see the quality of images that come out of this particular camera. The downside is that it's not, one of the downsides, I would say, to this is that it's not from, say, Canon or Nikon, where it would get the backing of a huge user base. And I think that's partially part of the downfall of this Foveon sensor, is that it's only really used by this one company, by Sigma. So Sigma actually seems to have bought the company Foveon, and so they seem to be locked in now to this sensor, so that all Sigma cameras will only be Foveon, and of course, the opposite being that no other manufacturers will get this Foveon sensor. So for better or for worse, that is sort of the state of the market right now. So after we talked about these different sensor technologies, we also talked about dynamic range and how us pulling data off of the camera results in a different dynamic range depending on a number of factors, not just the sensor itself. But we talked about how if we have a dynamic range that's too small, a dynamic range of the scene that's too small for the camera, then we just don't have as wide of a histogram as we would from a scene that has very wide dynamic range, that has much higher dynamic range from the scene itself. And so if you have a scene where the dynamic range is not very high, then you can easily bump up the contrast, because essentially what the contrast slider does is widen this aspect. The contrast just basically makes dark areas darker and bright areas brighter, or in other words, it sort of in effect shrinks the apparent dynamic range that you have in an image, for better or for worse. And so we talked about how one of the things, besides the sensor itself, that are important in determining the dynamic range of the camera as a whole is this additional piece of hardware called the analog to digital converter. And so because the sensor is actually an analog device where it just records the level of brightness in a voltage, we have to convert that somehow to actual binary, to an actual binary number that we can store in a file. And so we have to have this device called the analog to digital converter that does this job for us. And so if we have too low of an analog to digital converter, then we're just going to limit our dynamic range. But if we have too high of an analog to digital converter, we're wasting space. We're using too many bits because our sensor is not able to provide as much information as our analog to digital converter could give us. But usually they will pair the proper analog to digital converter to the sensor, and we get out of it a certain number of stops. So if we have a 12-bit analog to digital converter, then then that means that we have probably about 12 stops of information just because we can double or have the data 12 times when we are looking at this data. Of course, it depends entirely on the sensor. Many times the sensor will actually have a lower dynamic range output than the analog to digital converter, but this might be a good thing. This might reduce, or it might be a good thing in some sense in that it reduces some of the noise. And this was important because all of the output from this is very linear. In other words, all of the top half of the information is devoted to just the brightest stop that was captured by the sensor. And so there's this overabundance, or there's too many values that are given to this highest stop of information, even though we may not have all of our information in that section of the exposure. So we have to match this linear output to what our eyes actually see, and that's when we use the tone curve, where basically we give less importance to the highest stops of information. So this is the highest stop of information here, and we're saying that that's not very important to the output. It is important still, but it's not as important as the linear sensor would make apparent, and we are instead making the most important areas the sort of middle stops in the output of the sensor. So this matches how we see the scene in terms of luminance. But as you probably know, our eyes tend to play some tricks on us, more than just the apparent brightness of a scene, but also the apparent color of a scene as well. So you've probably seen us use this slide quite a few times before, but basically this is just the structure of the eye, and as you know, hopefully know by now, you know, the light comes in through the iris, and it's focused onto the rods and cones that exist in the back of the eye. And more specifically, we have this one section of the eye that's sort of the center of our vision, or what's called the macula that contains the fovea, that has the highest concentration of detail sensing cells that allow us to actually perceive in detail the scenes that we see. And so as you might recall, we have these two different types of cells in our eyes, and they each perform different functions. So we have the cone cells that do a number of things. So they're less sensitive, which means that they're better suited for brighter areas or for day vision. So they're concentrated in the fovea. They are very detail-oriented. They provide the color that we see in our vision. And we have a lot of them in the center part of our vision. But as you start going outside of the center of your vision, then, as you know, this is the peripheral vision. We don't have as much detailed sight as we do in the center. And part of the reason is because we start having many more cones, or rather many more rods in the outside of our vision than we do cones. And rods are very good for other things. They're more sensitive, which means that they are better for night vision. They're not really in the fovea much at all. And they're just because the fovea represents such a small percentage of the sight portion of our eye, we actually have many more times the number of rods in our vision than we do cones. And rods, they do not really provide to us the ability to detect color, but they are good for things like motion, which is part of the reason why it's a good thing that it's in our peripheral vision. It helps us detect if something is sort of, you know, flying towards our head or what have you. We can detect motion much better in our periphery than we can in the center. So imagine we have this setup, and what happens if the amount of light in a room decreases? Well, you can imagine that our cones start being are used less and less, and the rods are start becoming more important in our vision. So as the rods take over, you can imagine that our color perception actually starts to drop as the light gets darker. And in fact, this is exactly what happens. So the whole point of me telling you all of this is that our perception of color is dependent not only on well, many factors, on the amount of color that exists in the scene, but it also depends how much light is actually in the scene, because our eyes will use different cells to detect the color, and we might perceive color in a different way in a darker room than we would in a brighter room. And this happens very naturally for us. It's not something that we notice very actively, but this is something that is very important when we're talking about color detection in a camera, just because our perception of color changes very, very drastically. And so, as you might recall, when we were talking about cones, we have different cone types. So we have the M, the L, and the S type cones, and we have the vast majority of cones in our vision are actually M and L type. And these types actually provide to us the green vision, the red vision, and so on. We don't have as much color perception in the blue spectrum as we do. And this is part of the reason why the luminance is made, why luminance detection is made so important by green, just because we have so many more cones in our eye that can see this color than we have cones that can see this the lower wavelength blue or violet color in the color spectrum. And so the visible spectrum is made up of a range of wavelengths, basically in the electromagnetic spectrum, and we can see all of it. And you know, it's basically the rainbow, you know, Roy G. Biv, all the way from starting from red, orange, yellow, going through green, blue, violet. This is the range that we can actually perceive. And this is important because when we perceive or the variety of wavelengths that we can perceive, we need the color to, or rather we need the camera to also be able to perceive, and we also have to be able to accurately reproduce the color that existed in the scene. Not only should it be accurate, but also it should be accurate to how we would be able to see it. And so there's all of these complexities that can come up when we're talking about color, which is why, unfortunately, using or talking and dealing with color in a computer has been made into this really unnecessarily complex thing. But we will go through a lot of the things today and talk about them and hopefully make all of this quite a bit simpler. So the end result of all of this is that color perception is difficult. It's not easy for us to be able to perceive color supremely accurately. Our brains, our eyes work against us. They play tricks on us based on what our brains think the world should be looking like rather than what it actually looks like. And just to prove this to you, I'm going to show you a couple of optical illusions. And so there's this one here, which is basically made by a cylinder, expressing essentially a shadow onto a tile floor to the left. And the optical illusion is this. Do you see that there's two tiles? There's one marked A and there's one marked B. Now, what is the difference between these two tiles? Do they look different? So B appears to be brighter than A, right? But the optical illusion is that these are actually the exact same color. Because of the shadow, our brains are tricking us into thinking that for some reason this darker region in this shadow matches this. Well, basically, in essence, it's the same exact color. And I know that every time I show this, nobody believes me. So what I want to do is to prove this to you in a variety of ways. I want to find the color meter. So I'll bring up the color meter, which allows us, as you might recall, this allows us the ability to compare the values of color. So I can put it over this, for example, and this tells us that, here, I'll put it into decimal so that this looks a little bit more familiar. So that, for example, all white, this is what we expect. It's going to be all 255s in red, green, and blue. If I hover over something that's sort of greenish, we'll see that we have more green here than we have blue or red, so on and so forth. So basically, we should be able to see the raw values that make up these tiles. So I have right now my mouse over the A tile, and we can see that the values that make up this color are all the values 139. So it's about this middle gray. Okay, and so we can compare this to the lighter tile right next to it, where we can see that the values are higher. It's still a gray, but it's just a brighter gray, all 215s. But now if I hover my mouse, and so go back to A to remind you that it's all 139. Now if I hover my mouse over B, notice that the values are in fact exactly the same. And the reason for this really stems from the fact that the next door tile is what is sort of tricking us, and that it is getting darker. But so we can use this darker tile, where it used to be A, and replace it. And just because we have a darker tile right next to it, our eyes think that it should follow this same pattern, or our brains really perceive this as following the same pattern. It looks like my mic is messed up a little bit. One second. Okay, so I know that this is still sort of, you're still sort of looking at it and saying, okay, this doesn't make a lot of sense to me still. Perhaps perhaps Dan is playing a trick on us. So now I'm going to do something a little bit different to prove the same thing to you. So I've loaded up this same image in Photoshop, and what I'm going to do is I am going to use the eyedropper tool to pick up the color of A. And so now we can see in the color picker that, okay, we've picked up the value of A. And you'll notice that it's slightly different. This is actually because there is a difference in the way, well, this actually we will talk about in a little bit, where different programs can interpret color differently in the same thing, but it's still, the end result is the same, and relatively it still looks like exactly the same image to us. But basically we've detected this value A right here, and what I will do is create a little rectangle that will act as sort of a bridge between these tiles, and I will fill it with this color. So I'll just use the paint bucket tool and fill it. Let's see, I need to create a new layer. I will create a new layer and fill it with this color. And so this is the same color, and so now hopefully it becomes a little bit more apparent. Because we've broken the pattern, now you can actually see that, okay, maybe there is something to this where it is actually the same color. Breaking the pattern, in fact, makes all of this just appear darker, like it actually should be. Darker than the pattern that we saw in the lighter region as well. So all of this is just meant to show you that, yes, color perception is difficult for us. It's not, we don't see the world exactly as it actually is. So our eyes can play tricks on us. And I do actually have another one that I hope you will that you will indulge me with, another optical illusion here. Now what I want you to do, you'll notice that this is an image, and there's a black dot in the center of this image. And what I want you to do, and I promise nothing scary will happen, Halloween was 2 weeks ago, I want you to stare intently at the center, at the black dot of this image. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to leave this here for about 30 seconds or so, and then I'm going to change the slide. And on the next slide, it's not going to be a scary image. There's not going to be anything, you know, that will cause you to jump. It's just going to be basically the same thing, but altered ever so slightly, and you're going to perceive a difference in the color. And so basically what it's going to look like is that the color is actually going to look correct. What you are looking at now is an inverse of the actual color that existed in the scene. So if you imagine the inverse of this blue might have been some sort of a red, so on and so forth. So we're almost ready. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to switch the slides right now. So stare at it for a second and then sort of close your eyes, look away for a second and then come back to it. Do you notice a difference? So when you first saw this image, what did it look like? Did you see a red brick building? So you saw for just a brief moment the actual colors that were used in this image. Even though the original, what we were looking at was an inverse, and this next thing was just, it was just a black and white image, what you were seeing was the actual colors that made up this image. So what happens here? Well, as you know, our eyes adjust to the brightness of a scene, right? So when something is really bright, our eyes get used to it, and then suddenly we can start to look at it. And so there's this sort of feedback loop that occurs. Our eyes adapt to situations. And it's not just the brightness of a scene that our eyes adapt to, it's also the amount of color in a scene. If you are looking at something that's very heavily saturated, our eyes adapt to that and sort of counteract it in a way. And so they try to make it so that you are not, so eventually what you were looking at is not quite as saturated as what you were looking at before. So because this was the inverse, your eyes essentially got rid of the inverse colors. In other words, they adapted these inverse colors out of your vision for just a brief moment. And when you looked at the black and white version, what you got to see was the remnants or the actual original color version that existed just because our eyes had adapted to it. So after the color is removed, the inverse remains. The inverse colors or the original colors remains until our eyes readapt to the scenario. And so this sort of thing is actually pretty easy to do. You can take just sort of any image, you can go into Photoshop, you can invert the image, and then you can make another copy of that image and just turn it into a regular grayscale. Just put a black dot right in the center, and you can perform this same optical illusion with your friends and family as well. It's sort of a neat and fun way. And even you don't even have to look at it for 30 seconds. It can just be a few seconds, and you can see for just a quick moment the color that existed in this original scene. So this is sort of a fun way of demonstrating that our color perception is not, it's just like our brightness perception. It adapts based on the situation. So if we try to apply some numbers to all of this stuff, so what is going on, you might, if you ever look at anything color related or that deals with colors, you might see a graph that looks like this, which is basically supposed to represent a color space. So a color space, all it is just a gamut or an array of colors, a range of colors, who in collection we would call a color space. So this graph right now is supposed to be representative of all of the colors that your average human being can see. So along the edges are the monochromatic colors. So along the edges you will see like a deep violet and blue, all the way up to green and red, so on and so forth. This is along the edges what we would see if you were looking at a light that only gives off one wavelength. So for example, you're looking at like a red LED and all it is giving off a red light, then you would be looking at something along this red line. Now you'll notice that there are colors in the middle, in between all of this area, and this represents a mixture of these so-called monochromatic colors. So monochromatic color is a color that's given off by something that only has that one wavelength. So like that LED in this example, it's not giving off any other wavelengths, it's only this one red wavelength. Now this is in contrast to what you might know from an incandescent light, for example, which gives off all sorts of wavelengths. And so in combination, it's not a monochromatic color anymore, we get a mixture of color, we get a mixture of light. And that's what's at the center of this diagram. As you mix different quantities of monochromatic light together, you will get a color that appears to be a mixture of the two. So in other words, anything that's on this furthest outside edge, this is as saturated of a color as is possible, because it is the purest form of that color. And you can make up a whole bunch of colors by mixing colors together, but it's never going to be as purely saturated as if you were at the far outside region. So you can mix together a blue and a green to get this sort of cyan color, but it's not going to be as saturated as if you were looking at an actual monochromatic cyan light. So you'll notice that there's an x-axis this way and a y-axis on this graph, and the y-axis is used to represent the luminosity. So how we would perceive the luminosity of these colors. And this matches exactly what we talked about when we talked about the luminosity function, right? We said that blue was sort of perceived as the darkest, red is sort of perceived as the next brightest, and this is all going up in this vertical scale. So blue is the darkest, red is brightest, and green up there is the absolute brightest in terms of luminosity. Now on the x-axis, we have a measure of what's called chromaticity, or basically how much color we perceive it, we perceive that color having. So red appears to be a lot more perhaps vibrant, you might say, than green or blue. And this is sort of a different measure, but in combination, we have this entire gamut of colors, or all of the colors that we can perceive. So mixtures of light, like I said, appear to us to be monochromatic light, but they're not. There's a significant difference between mixing two colors together and actually perceiving an actual monochromatic light. So, like I said, if I can repeat this example that I mentioned before, if you mix like a blue right here and a green that's somewhere up here, you might get this sort of cyan color that exists right between the two, like about where the mouse is hovering right now. But that's not going to be as saturated as the cyan color that exists towards the edge that's here. Now we can mix together a whole bunch of colors, like we can mix together red and blue. We can get this sort of purplish color in the center. Like I said, we can mix blue and green, get cyan. We can mix red and green and get this yellow color. We can just get a whole bunch of different colors mixing these monochromatic lights, monochromatic things, monochromatic lights together. Okay. Now, when we look at a computer screen, this is exactly the thing that it tries to replicate, is that a computer screen or television screen, as you know, is made up of a whole bunch of little LEDs generally in the newest technology that we have. And usually these LEDs are made up of a red light, a blue light, and a green light, whose combination through a variety of brightness levels will make a range of colors. So we might then say that, okay, if we have a blue LED, it might give off a maximum blue light that's about here. If we have a red LED, it might give off a maximum red light that is about there. And so this is meant to show you about how saturated each of these can possibly be. And if we have a green one, we can mix a green color that's all the way up there. And so if we combine all of these together, we would get a white pixel. And that white pixel is about here in the center, what's called D65 is just the name of a color cast of just a specific type of white. So just like we have different colors of whites like eggshell and whatever else, there's different numeric names that we can label these white colors as well. And so D65 is just one example, and it tends to be the most common that you will find in computers and television. And this is meant to be sort of the combination of the red, green, and blue should target this D65 white color. Now, notice something that happens as a result of this. Because we are mixing together a red, a green, and a blue, we cannot get the most saturated colors that actually exist in the world. In other words, if we try to make a cyan by combining a blue pixel and a green pixel, our cyan would be about here, where the tip of my mouse is. And this is not as saturated as a fully cyan monochromatic light would be. And this is important. What this tells us is that no computer screen, no projector screen can actually reproduce all of the colors that we can perceive. And this is just because of the fact that we are trying to mix together three colors only to make up a whole variety of colors that really can be generated by just individual wavelengths. So just because of this fact that mixing two colors together generally results in a color that is not quite as saturated to our eyes as the original monochromatic color, this is the problem that we have. Okay, so I was talking about this triangle as if it were a projector screen or a computer screen or what have you, but this is actually what's called a color space. There's actually a name associated with these three points and all of the colors in between. And this particular color space is called sRGB. And sRGB is an extremely common color space. It is the one that you're going to use almost exclusively, all the time. Whenever you publish something on the internet, whenever you're looking at something on your computer, consumer cameras use this. Pretty much everything that is common with the digital camera will use this sRGB color space. Now, notice that we have actually a pretty big deficiency in this color space. We are underrepresenting the amount of green that we can perceive in the world. So there's other competing color spaces that can attempt to capture more of the colors that are available in the world and try to represent them on the screen, as an example. And so there's another one that's very popular called Adobe RGB. Now notice the difference between Adobe RGB and sRGB. That is that Adobe RGB extends much farther into the green area than the sRGB does. Now, Adobe RGB it gives us a lot more color information in the green region, but this can result in a couple of downsides, and that is that I don't think there's any projector or display that can actually produce all of the green colors that exist in Adobe RGB. You'll get some weird color artifacts if you process a photo in Adobe RGB and you try to send it to somebody else who then doesn't know how to look at a photo in the appropriate color space. There's a whole host of problems with Adobe RGB, but the reason that you would do it is if you're going to print something. If you're going to print something, generally Adobe RGB has a large enough color space that you'll be able to accurately, or rather more accurately, print some of the colors that existed in your original photo. Now, it's important to realize that these color spaces are applied to the image itself. So in other words, if I have an image that is tagged with an sRGB color space, we still have these values that I was talking about, these values from 0 to 255 for each of the major colors, for the red color, the green color, and the blue color. The difference between these is what those values actually represent. So in other words, if I had a pixel that had a value of 0 for red, a value of 0 of blue, and a value of 255 for green, then assuming that my computer can properly display this green in the sRGB color space, it will appear to my eyes to be that portion of the triangle right there. It will appear that will be the green that I will actually perceive. Now, if I have this same pixel with the same values of 0 for red, 0 for blue, and 255 for green, and instead I apply a color space of Adobe RGB, what this is telling the computer is that, okay, well, now I know that that means that this green should actually be way up there instead. So it's not that the values are different, it's just what we're calling these values, what these values actually represent. You can think of this as sort of a really fancy paint-by-number system. You might recall these paint-by-number books where you'd buy a book, you'd get some watercolor paints or what have you, you'd mix them together maybe, and there would be numbers in each of the sections. And so you would, all of the sections that had the number 1, you would paint a blue color. All of the sections that had a number 2, you would paint a green color, for example. That's essentially what we're doing. We're calling these values to be different colors. And this is the importance. What we want is to have accurate color reproduction, as accurate as possible, according to the original scene that I took a photo of. So if my camera calls the green of my shirt, for example, a value of 255, how does the computer know what that green means? How does it know that it's this green all the way up here versus this green sort of down here? There's no way for a computer to know that by itself unless we apply this color space. This is the whole point of the color space, is that it allows us to reproduce these colors in a more accurate fashion, just because the computer knows, okay, a value of 255 in the sRGB color space means that I am supposed to print out a color, or I'm supposed to display a color that looks exactly like that. So this is a matter of color reproduction and accurately reproducing the colors that existed in a scene. And different color spaces will apply different colors for different values. So just to show you an example of some of the variation that we might see in color spaces, I have here an application that's included actually with most Macs called the Color Sync Utility. And the Color Sync Utility allows you to view essentially that graph for all of the color spaces that happen to exist on your computer. And you might have seen a number of these color spaces on your own computer just sort of in passing, but maybe didn't really know what to do with it or know really what it meant. One example that we might see, for example, is here. If I go to the display preferences, I can have a profile for my projector, for example. And we're saying right now that it's set to sRGB versus some other color profile. And so this is sort of the same idea. It's in a different context, and I'll talk about the different context in just a second, but it's sort of the same idea where we're applying a color space to this projector. So in other words, the value of 255 and 255 and 255 that make up this white pixel right here means that it's actually supposed to appear to be a certain color white. But if I change the display profile, you might see that the colors actually seem to change in some significant way. So this is sort of the same idea, but what I'm talking about right now is not in this context, but in the context of a photo itself. So back to sRGB. Okay, so if I have various color profiles or various color spaces, we can look and see how some of these are actually different. So we can see that in the sRGB color profile, we actually get this range of colors, which is not a whole lot compared to the actual range of colors that can exist in the world. So if I want to compare this against Adobe RGB, we can now see, let's see, I should do this the other way. Clear and hold. Okay, so this is Adobe RGB, and I can put right on top of it sRGB. We can see that Adobe RGB, the values, the maximum values for Adobe RGB mean more saturated colors in general. And so this might be, you might think, oh, this is a great thing. Why don't I just use Adobe RGB? And now my values now the values in my image that are very high will appear to be more saturated. Well, this, it's sort of a good thought, but there's a lot more complexity that goes into it, because the computer has to interpret the color space, and not all computers, not all pieces of software interpret the color space the same. And this is part of what a lot of the complexity from all of this color stuff comes from, but don't worry about it. Like I said before, we'll explain it in just a minute. Just assume, or just take for granted right now, that sRGB is what you should be using for pretty much everything, except printing. If you're going to print your image, then you might as well use Adobe RGB. That's probably a better color space because you have more colors to work with, or a wider gamut of colors to work with. But if you're destining your image for anything else, pretty much, for sending it to your friends, putting it on the internet, saving it to your phone, what have you, then sRGB is the way to go. Now, we can compare this gamut to what is possible through some hardware devices. So, for example, I have a printer at home called an Epson R800, something stupid like that. And we can actually see how the gamut, how the output gamut of this printer is different from RGB, or rather sRGB or Adobe RGB. So we can see that here, this is the expected output of my printer on some specific paper, on matte paper, and we can see that this does not actually, it can't actually create all of the colors that exist in Adobe RGB. If I look at photo paper, this is sort of the widest gamut. Now you can see that in some cases the printer can actually create more colors than this color space can actually create. This is one of the reasons why I recommend using Adobe RGB, which is a huge color space that encapsulates many more of the colors that's available, just because you're more likely to get these sort of fringe colors out here. But you can still see that there's some areas where we're lacking a little bit. And now, just to really sort of drive this home, I want to show you the color LCD. Now, the color LCD is the profile that I'm using on my laptop right now. And you'll get to see the difference between Adobe RGB and what my display can actually produce. And it's a small fraction of the colors that Adobe RGB can actually produce. And in fact, this is much closer to sRGB than it is to Adobe RGB. And this is true for just about all of the monitors that exist on the market today. So if I hold sRGB for comparison, we can compare that to the color, to the capabilities of my monitor, and you can see that still it's not quite there, but it's a lot closer. And in fact, this is sort of what this is the color space that a lot of manufacturers try to aim their color reproduction for. They try to say, okay, I want to fill the sRGB space, just because that's the one that's most used. And what I'm talking about when I say filling the sRGB space is that we know that the sRGB space is defined as this range of colors made by this triangle, so I want to have a display that can reproduce these colors perfectly, that can reproduce these colors accurately, because then I will be able to display the colors in an image in an accurate way. Now, better monitors will be able to display more colors, and this is one of the reasons why laptop monitors are actually really bad for doing any sort of, well, it's a bit of an over exaggeration to say this, to say that laptop monitors are really bad for any photo editing, but in terms of accurate color reproduction, they are not very good, is what I'm trying to say. And we'll talk more about hardware in just a little bit. So we have these color spaces, and again, these color spaces are applied to an image itself. So it's embedded within the image as part of the metadata, so that the computer knows, okay, I know that this image wants to use the sRGB color space, which means that a value of 255 in green represents that green way up there, and I'm going to try to display that green color to the user in however accurate of a form I can do it. Now, color management as a whole, there's some additional steps that I just talked about just a second ago that go into actually reproducing this color accurately. Not only does the computer have to know, okay, when I interpret this value as being meaning this specific color, how do I tell the monitor, how do I tell the monitor or the display to actually generate that color? because the monitor also has, as you saw just a minute ago, it also has its own gamut. It has its own capabilities in displaying each of these colors. My LCD monitor is pretty crappy compared to the sRGB space that exists. This projector, I guarantee, is probably even worse. It doesn't have that many, just cannot seem to produce that many colors. So how can a computer know what, when it looks at a value of 255 for green in a pixel on an image, how does it know how to actually produce that color? Well, this is where color management comes into play. And there exists this idea of profiles. And profiles are what we just saw when you looked at, when we were looking at the display preferences for my monitor, and we saw a whole bunch of listings there. Those were different profiles. And the profiles tell the computer how it can reproduce the color accurately. Now, most of the time, when you get a computer, it comes with a default profile, and generally, that default profile is kind of okay, but it's not going to be perfect. It's not going to be able to reproduce the colors extremely accurately. Usually, you have to actually perform a profile on your, and profile is a verb in this case, you actually have to profile your monitor so that you know what colors can be represented by what values. And there exist very specialized pieces of hardware that you put on top of your computer whose sole job in life is to generate colors on your computer monitor and realize how different that color looks to what it thinks it should be. So in other words, it sends a value to the monitor, and it says, okay, this is the value that I think you should be producing for the color green. And then there's a little piece of hardware that sits on top of your monitor, and it reads that green value that's produced by your monitor or by your projector, and it says, okay, I expected this value green, but I got this value for green. And so it learns how to adjust the value so that it can print out, or rather it can display the green color to you that it wants to be able to do. And so there's this multiple step process that occurs. There's a color space for an image that tells the computer, okay, this value of 255 means that I want this value for green. This is just sort of an abstract color for green. Then the computer takes that through the working color space, that's the sort of central part, and it says, okay, I have to produce this color green. Now I tell this profile I want to produce this color green, and this profile then tells the monitor, okay, I want to produce this color green, so I'm going to send you this value. And the end result, if you have a properly calibrated monitor with a properly generated profile, is that you will see an accurate color based on whatever value existed in your image. And this is an important distinction. Color profiling is really, people don't put enough emphasis on this. In fact, color profiles from one computer to the next can vary wildly. I mean, it is really obvious at times. When you look at your computer and you're looking at an image and you go to a friend's computer, you sort of take for granted that that image is going to look a little bit different, right? That maybe their display is going to be a little bit more washed out, or maybe it's not going to be quite have as much contrast as your image. This is actually a big problem for us as photographers. How do we accurately display the image that we had in mind, our vision for this image, across all computers? I'm going to spoil it for you right now and tell you that for the average person, you're not going to be able to display it accurately. You can sort of do a best effort by setting a color space that is used most frequently. So by using sRGB color space, which is used in the vast majority of devices in the world, and that will help you a little bit. And also setting the contrast level to a certain amount, and we'll talk about that in just a moment, so that you can be reasonably sure that your contrast will look the same from one computer to the next. But in general, this is a big problem, and we as photographers should at the very least profile and calibrate our own machines so that we can accurately reproduce the colors on our computers, so that we know, okay, when I'm looking at this image, this is how I want it to be. And you have to accept that when you send that image somewhere else, it's correct, but most likely it will look a little bit off on, you know, compared to your vision, it will look a little bit off on somebody else's computer. Okay, let's take a quick 5-minute break. When we come back, we'll continue talking about color profiles. Welcome back, everybody. So before the break, we were talking about color management and the importance of having color spaces attributed to images, but also color profiles that are associated with your output devices. So your printers might be color profiled so that the computer knows how to produce or print out inaccurate color on your printer. And same, you might have a different profile for your monitor or for your projector. And while I mentioned the existence of these hardware products that you can use to actually take actual raw color measurements of your computer screen, they tend to be a bit expensive. You might spend $100 to a couple hundred dollars, to the most expensive ones being thousands of dollars that can profile all sorts of devices from printers to projectors to screens. But frankly, you don't have to do this. You can get sort of good enough results by doing software color profiling. And there exists some software tools that you can available or that you can download online that basically perform a number of tricks that allow you to adjust the color and try to get an accurate color profile on your monitor. And it's not going to be perfect. You're going to get a slight color cast in some form or another, but it's definitely better than nothing, I would say. And it's at least worth giving a shot to accurately profile your monitor. If you have a Mac, you'll notice that on your display preferences under color, you have a calibrate button. And if you click that button, it brings up the display calibration assistant. And if you go into expert mode, you can actually do this. And it basically boils down to having an image that looks like this, and the projector is doing something sort of funky with it here. But basically what you have to do is try to match the color that you perceive between these lines to the color that's in the center of the box as well. And you do this for a variety of grays and for a variety of colors. And from that, the computer tries to generate an accurate profile on your monitor. And again, it's not going to be perfect. Like we talked about in the first half, our eyes play tricks on us when it comes to color. And frankly, it gets to be a little bit difficult to squint at this to try to get the lines to meld together into one color. But it is at least better than nothing. And if you're on a Windows machine, there are available some downloads that you can do sort of a similar thing and use that profile on your computer monitor to accurately, or at least more accurately, get some colors. And I definitely recommend at least attempting it and trying to get some of your color profile correct. And I guarantee the first time you do it, it's going to look really funky. The colors are going to look really off and really strange to you on your computer. But if you do it a couple of times, eventually you'll start to realize, oh, hey, this orange looks actually very nicely saturated. It actually looks like a proper orange. And you might actually notice that the color quality will go up slightly. But again, it can't match the quality of a hardware profiler, but it's sort of an expense that you have to work your way up to if you want to actually profile your monitor with a hardware profile. So we've talked about how there's a variety of different color spaces available and how each of these, they don't modify the values of the files themselves, but rather what each of these values represent. Like we were talking about before, this idea of painting by numbers. If there's a number here, what color does that number represent? But there's an obvious problem here. What if we have an image that's in one color space and we want to try to convert it to a different color space? What do we do in this case? So you can see that we, in Adobe RGB, for example, we have a lot more green that is possible than we do in sRGB. So what happens when we try to convert from one to the next? And there exists this idea called gamut mapping, that we actually can perform different types of conversions depending on what we want. And there's a whole bunch available. There's two sort of major ones, one being perceptual and the other being colorimetric, and they are different in a couple of important ways. Perceptual basically will try to take whatever's the bigger gamut, so it will take whatever colors existed in the big one, and it will try to fit all of them into the narrower gamut. So in essence, what you're getting is slightly less saturation in the image, because you can't represent quite as many colors, but this is better because you don't have any colors that are sort of dead ends. You're not blocking off any colors and saying, okay, any color that's more saturated than this, I'm just going to call this one color. What you might do in that case is you're just essentially, for lack of a better word, clipping some colors with your gamut. And instead, what you're doing is you're preserving the relative look of the colors in this way. And so perceptual is generally what we are going to use for photographs. Almost all of the time, you want to use the perceptual type gamut mapping when converting your photograph from one to the other, just because it's going to maintain the relative look of that photograph, and that's going to be more important. Now, if you're actually doing something where maintaining the absolute color perfection is absolutely required, then you might use something like colorimetric. What colorimetric does is it maps whatever colors it can, and it just destroys all of the rest. So in other words, what it says is that, okay, if I have a value of 255 for green, and that means it's this super bright green color, but I can't produce this super bright green color, then I am just not going to bother trying, and I'm going to convert it so that it is no more saturated than whatever's the most saturated version I can do. So in other words, you're potentially clipping colors in the case of a colorimetric gamut map. So this reproduces the in-gamut map. So this reproduces the colors that fit within this gamut exactly as they existed before, but you might destroy some of the relative color differences that you had in the image. This might actually destroy the look of your image, and it's not going to be a good reversible way of displaying or of converting from one color space to the next. Now, I know that using Photoshop can be kind of a harrowing experience, and if you ever have bothered to look at the Photoshop color settings, that can be even more of a difficult thing to get through, just because there happen to be so many different types of colors available. And so if we want to look at if you want to look at some of the color settings, what you can do is go into Photoshop, and under the edit menu there is this color settings menu item, and you can look at all of the color settings that exist for Photoshop. And now I know that there's a lot of color settings here, but I feel like this is useful to show you what I use and explain why some of these are in use to try to make this a little bit easier. It looks like they may have been destroyed. Okay, one second. I'm going to try one more thing. So basically what we have is a variety of different color options that are available. Notice that we can select default color spaces for each of these for each of the different color types that we have. Let's see, I'm just waiting for this to load. And one of the things that we want to do is to make sure that we preserve as much color information as we can. And one second, I'm just loading up Photoshop on my other machine to see if hopefully it's still there. Nope, it's not. Of course not. Okay. So this will be more interesting. Now, when we're talking about working spaces, these are the color spaces that are used by Photoshop when you're typically working on an image. So if an image, for whatever reason, does not have a color space, you might tell Photoshop to just go ahead and use a specific color space anyway. And so working with or having default color spaces is pretty useful. And generally, what you're going to be working with is RGB, and you're really not going to be working with CMYK, gray, or spot all of that much. So I would say that the most important one to deal with is RGB, and generally this should be set to sRGB. Now you'll notice that sRGB typically has a lot of stuff after it, IEC 61966-2.1. This is just the specification number for that sRGB, but we can simplify it and just call it sRGB. Generally, what you want for your working space is sRGB. Now, the color management policies, these options can actually mean you can actually change depending on what you want to do with it. But if you open up, basically what's happening is that if you open up an image, what the color policy means, or the color management policy means, is what Photoshop is going to do with the color space that exists in that image. So if I have an image, what I want to do most or almost all of the time is preserve whatever color space it is. So even though my working space is an sRGB, if I open an image that's an Adobe RGB, I want to preserve that. I don't want to convert it quite yet. I might want to do it at a later point, but you want to at least preserve whatever color space that is actually in. You could, if you really wanted to, convert all of the images that you open to convert to working RGB, but this might cause some confusion down the line, and I'd suggest that this that it's better to leave it at preserve embedded profiles. Now, you'll notice that we have a couple of other things. So if we have profile mismatches or missing profiles, many of you, if you've worked with Photoshop, you may have already disregarded some of these errors. You may have opened up an image and it might have said something like, this image has no color profile, what do you want to do? And that may not have made a lot of sense at the time, but hopefully now it makes a little bit more sense. And in fact, I would suggest that you have it ask you when it's opening a file what it should do when it's opening a file that doesn't have a color profile or that has a color profile that doesn't match your working space. You might want to just have it ask you what you want to do. In this case, if you open up an image and it doesn't have a color profile, maybe there's cases where you don't want to apply one. Maybe it's just like a screenshot or something where the color really doesn't matter all that much. Then you can ignore the fact that it doesn't have a color profile. But if you open up an image and it is supposed to have a color profile because it's, say, a photograph, then you might apply an sRGB profile to it and begin working with it that way. So this way you can start working with color profiles in Photoshop sort of right away, just because these using profiles is definitely an important way of getting accurate color out of your manipulations of your image. Now, I mentioned before that your profiling your monitor is really, really important, and displaying colors accurately is a really good way of making sure that you are able to send your photos elsewhere and ensure that you will get the most accurate color reproduction possible, not only on other computers, but also if you send your photos to a printer, for example. And most of the time, if you send them to a printer, you have to sort of assume that they profiled their printer properly, but you can have at least done your part, where you have made sure that your profile or that your computer is, your monitor is profiled to display proper colors to you. Now, there's actually an important distinction between a number of monitors. Not all monitors are made the same. In fact, there's different types of monitors that exist on the market today. So there's a whole bunch of what are called panels. The panels are the actual monitor part of a monitor. And there's different types of panels that exist. So we have, obviously we have the LCD type, you know, the flat screen type. We have the older type, the CRT, the big fat television, old television style ones. Those typically actually have better color reproduction than LCDs, because LCDs change over time. And even though you profile your LCD, literally within weeks or within a month or two, the color perception will shift ever so slightly, and you have to reprofile your monitor. Whereas CRTs tend to hold the color a little bit better, and they also can produce a wider array of colors than the LCD technology that we have these days. But even within LCD, there's different versions, there's different types of panels available. And if you're looking at purchasing a new monitor and you are serious about modifying and editing your photos, then I suggest taking a look at what type of monitor you are about to purchase. SIPS is S-IPS is a monitor type that's sort of considered the highest quality LCD right now. If you're going to purchase a monitor, look at trying to get an SIPS monitor. And typically, you might wonder, well, when you looked at LCD prices before, you might wonder, well, all right, here's a 20-inch monitor that costs $100, and here's a 20-inch monitor that costs $800. What is the difference between these two? And most likely, it is the quality of the panel that is inside of it. The quality of the color reproduction is just one of the things that the quality of the panel will actually give to you. So SIPS is sort of the highest quality panel that you can get. Then there's others like SPVA, that's sort of the next best below SIPS, and STN, and that you really want to avoid those at all costs. Those are going to be sort of bottom of the barrel. I will try to print out a green to you, but it's actually going to look orange sort of monitor. That's not going to be the best quality that you have available. So if you're looking at monitor types, look at SIPS. Now, laptop versus desktop, there's even a significant difference between those as well. Laptop LCDs tend to have much worse quality than the desktop counterparts. So even if you have a laptop and if you are serious about modifying your photos one of the things you might consider is getting a monitor that you have on your desk at home that is relatively high quality. So you don't have to ditch your laptop just because it has a, you know, not as high of a quality as a desktop monitor, but you could get a separate monitor to try to reproduce the colors more accurately and modify all of your photos on that monitor instead of your laptop. Now, there's even a difference in the number of photos that all of these panels can display. So we've talked at length about how JPEGs, for example, can display 8 bits worth of color information, right? So we said that, okay, a JPEG file has 8 bits of red, 8 bits of green, eight bits of blue, and all combined together, that's, you know, a lot of colors that can be reproduced in this JPEG. Now, not all, as you saw in the ColorSync utility, not all displays are actually created equally. And in fact, a number of laptop displays can only display 6-bit color. They can only display 2 to the 6 times number of colors at each individual pixel. And they get away with this by using something called dithering. And dithering is a bad thing that you want to try to, well, it's not a bad thing. It's a relatively good thing in what it attempts to do, but it's bad for us in trying to get accurate color reproduction because it fools us into thinking that this computer can generate more colors than it actually can, because if I can only produce 6 bits of information, what it is assuming or what it's going to try to do is if it realizes that it needs to display a green pixel here, and this green has to be a certain value, what it will do is it might actually change the adjacent pixel ever so slightly so that when we look at the screen as a whole, it mixes, when we look at it, essentially mixes the two colors, and it tries to generate a color that by itself the LCD panel cannot generate, if that makes sense. So the raw pixel itself cannot generate this one color. So what it will do is it will try to trick you into thinking it can by making adjacent pixels, by mixing colors from adjacent pixels to give the perception that it's producing this color. And as we just talked about, mixing color isn't quite as good as actually producing that one color. So it's generally better to have a higher quality panel that can produce those different colors and display them to you accurately. So using the takeaway from this is to be really careful when using your laptop for color management. And another thing that you might have noticed is that if you take your laptop and you sort of tilt it one direction or another, the color changes drastically as well. That's another big issue. If you profile your monitor and you start getting sort of lazier and you slump a little bit in your chair, you'll actually perceive the color differently than you did when you profiled it and you were sitting up straight. So you have to be accurate not only in your monitor but also in the way you're sitting and looking at the monitor also. Yes?
Just a quick question about Mac laptops. Mm-hmm. Would this be an example where they're using a higher quality screen for the laptops?
In general, yes. In general, the Apple, particularly the higher-end Apple laptops like the MacBook Pros, tend to use higher quality screens than their PC counterparts. It's one of the reasons why, there's a whole bunch of reasons, but it's one of the reasons why Macs in general tend to be a little bit more expensive. Also, and now though Apple has a number of desktop displays as well, and I think they recently changed it, but almost all of their displays that I've ever seen all use SIPS. So they're sort of the highest quality. And this is one of the reasons why people say you want to do accurate color, you should get a Mac. This is one of the reasons why, is that they've made available the highest quality of whatever technology, you know, they can offer. And that's one reason why. Now, some of the smaller laptops that Apple offers, like the MacBook Airs, for example, the really thin ones, they suffer a little bit in quality, but that's just because they, you know, sort of out of necessity. It's just much smaller screen than what you can have in the MacBook Pro. But still, it's I think generally they're supposed to be better than their counterparts. But I'm sure there's exceptions to this in general. But yes. Okay. Now, so in general, like I said, desktop monitors in general are better than laptop monitors. And even within desktop monitors, there's different versions, or there's different types of technologies that can produce different quality output. Now, there's one more aspect of color management that is really important for us to talk about, and that is this idea of gamma. And gamma is basically a setting that you set on your display that basically is just the contrast of your display. And what altering the gamma will do is increase or decrease the contrast on your display. And for a long time, for many years, there was a difference in the gamma value between Macs and PCs. Macs were generally set before at a value of 1.8, and PCs in general were set to a value of 2.2 or higher. Many PCs are at really high values, like 2.5 or 2.8 or what have you. And the higher the value of gamma, the more contrast you will actually see in your image. And this was actually a really big problem for Mac users. If you used a Mac with an older version of the operating system, what this meant was that you would saturate your images to a certain degree. Now, they would look nicely saturated to you, but you would send it to somebody else, and they would look oversaturated because their gamma is different. It's a different value than what you had on your computer. So the recommendation is that you set your gamma to a value of 2.2. That's so we've talked about sRGB, that's the sRGB value or the color space that you should use. The gamma value that you should use is 2.2. If yours happens to be a little bit higher, bring it down a little bit. If yours happens to be a little bit lower, bring it up. So Windows by default has used 2.2 or higher. Macs in the old days used to use 1.8, but as of the latest version, 10.6, that was available I think last year, they changed it to 2.2 to finally match the rest of the industry. But if you have an older Mac that does not have the version 10.6 of the operating system, you should modify your display settings to use the gamma version or to use a gamma value of 2.2. And just to show you what this actually means for us, I'll skip all of this stuff. We can actually modify the gamma value here. You can see that by decreasing the gamma, we're decreasing the contrast. And by increasing it, we are increasing the contrast here. So that's really it just is a one-to-one relationship to contrast. And generally what you want is 2.2. Unless you're doing a lot of pre-press work, then you might change it to 1.8. But if you're doing pre-press work, you probably knew that already. So gamma is important. Set it to 2.2. Use sRGB. These are really important aspects of color management. Now, just because we've talked about color management doesn't mean that we're done with color. We haven't even started talking about what all of this means in the camera itself. What happens when we take a picture? Well, there's a couple of important aspects when it comes to taking a picture with your camera. And that is that, yes, if you're taking a JPEG photo, your camera is going to apply a color space to it. Almost always it will be sRGB. But also, there's when we perceive the world, we actually see we can actually adjust what's called the white balance. Our eyes look at white differently depending on the amount of available color in a room. So what we perceive this as white here, but a camera might actually look at this and say, okay, it actually looks a little green to me, or it actually looks a little brown to me, depending on the type of color that exists. And this exists because of this idea of color temperature. So just the amount of color that exists in a scene can actually impact the way that we view a white color in the scene. So as you might know, incandescent lighting, for example, is very, very warm. Candles, for example, are extremely warm. They just give off this sort of reddish glow, and that's all you really see is this sort of reddish glow. And so that a candle has a very different color temperature than an incandescent light. And an incandescent light has a very different color temperature than fluorescent lights, so on and so forth. And even the sun gives off different colors. Well, no, it gives off a constant color temperature, but based on the sun's placement relative to us on the ground, we can actually perceive different color temperatures. So it will be a bit cooler, for example, when the sun is higher up versus when it's lower in the sky. And this is one of the reasons why choosing time of day is important, because the color temperature will actually go up a little bit. It will actually appear to be warmer in later in the day than it will midday. So where does this idea of temperature come from? Well, you'll notice that we have here a couple of lines representing different color temperatures. Notice that we have a 3000 Kelvin line. That's this orange line, which means that the vast majority of the light is this sort of warm light. It more closely matches incandescent than it would something else, versus, say, midday, which would be this sort of middle yellow line, which is about 5000 Kelvin, versus something that's very, very cool, Like maybe what you would get in a snow scene, for example. Snow tends to have really sort of cool light, and which would give us a value of 9,000. Now, realize that this seems sort of counterintuitive, right? We're talking about color temperature, and I'm using this measure of temperature of Kelvin, but it seems that as we go up in color temperature, the light seems to be getting bluer, or what we would perceive as being cooler. Realize that this is just sort of an interesting side effect of the way that we describe these colors. So what happens, just recall what happens, you know that a red flame is supposed to be cooler than a blue flame, right? It's the same idea. There's the hotter the temperature of an object, the cooler the light it will actually give off. So it's sort of just the opposite of what you would expect, just because of the way that we have defined these terms. It's just sort of an unhappy coincidence in this case. So just think of it again in terms of, the blue flame and the red flame. The blue flame has a hotter temperature, has a hotter actual physical temperature, but it gives off bluer light than the cooler flame, which gives off this warmer light. And that's where this difference comes from. Though, to be more specific, this actually comes from something called black body radiation. If you have some object in space and it has a specific temperature, it's going to give off an array of radiation, and the peak of that radiation is what corresponds to this white balance. So in other words, if we have a star that's whose surface is up to 5,000 Kelvin or 3,000 Kelvin, then we'll get a distribution of color that looks like this, warmer, these warmer tones. And if we have a hotter star, then we get these cooler tones. So that's really what it comes from. But again, you can think of it in terms of that flame that I mentioned just a moment ago. And so how does this map to what we saw before? Well, it maps sort of like this. If we have very high color temperature, it sort of moves closer and closer to blue. And if we have a cooler color temperature, it just moves closer to this red area of the visible spectrum that we might see. Now, depending on the light that's available in a scene, you will get a different color temperature within it. So if you're taking a photo in incandescent lighting, you're going to have a different distribution of colors than you would if you took that same photo in sunlight. And so the camera has to have some way of applying this white balance and defining what is actually white within the scene. And some cameras do this better than others. Canon cameras are really bad. I have a Canon camera, and it's really bad at incandescent lighting. For some reason, it just makes it far too warm. You always have to go back later and cool off the colors just a little bit. So basically, there are a couple of ways to combat this. You can allow the camera to do this automatically, try to automatically detect the white balance. But another thing you can do is actually try to use like a white balance card, basically a white sheet of paper. You've probably seen Chris, our videographer, use one at the very beginning of class, where she tries to set the white balance of the room by setting up a white card, like right here. And she takes a picture of it, in essence, with the camera, and she tells the camera, this should be white. And so the camera then sets the white balance according to whatever it sees in the scene. You can do a similar thing with your camera, where you can set a custom white balance. If you have something that you know is supposed to be white, you can point your camera to it, take a picture of it, and tell the camera that this picture should actually represent the color white, and it will adjust the color temperature accordingly. Now, generally, automatic white balance will be pretty good. It's not going to be perfect, like I mentioned, but many cameras also have available manual settings, so you can manually set the white balance to incandescent lights, or to fluorescent lights, or to sunny days, or to overcast days. Frankly, I find this to be cumbersome and very error-prone, just because even though an overcast day will generally have a certain color temperature, it's always going to have some variability, and so it's much better to actually take an actual reading with a white card and figure out what the actual color temperature will be, rather than just relying on the camera's just sort of presets that exist. So in general, I don't use those presets. I use almost exclusively auto white balance or the custom white balance to set it up. And typically the custom white balance is best used if you know that the color is not going to change. So a studio setup, for example, this would be a very good thing. You could take a picture of a white card and set the white balance and then be reasonably sure that your white balance is going to be pretty much perfect throughout the rest of your shoot. But if you're outside, you may not want to do that unless you know that the light is, or you're somehow guaranteeing that the light is not going to change, just because it can and it will change over time as the sun goes down in the sky. Now, just to show you, I mean, when we take a photo in the raw format, we actually are saying that we are not setting the white balance quite yet, and we can actually redefine what the white balance might be. So I have here a couple of raw files, and if we take a look at this, so realize that it's showing us, this red thing is not actually part of the image, it's just showing us portions that it thinks might be overexposed. It's just a warning that it's providing to us. But this was the white balance that the camera thought this scene should be, and it looks a little bit darker than I intend, so what I'll do is I'll just artificially increase the exposure a little bit, and no, that's too much. So it looks like this, but this isn't actually what the scene looked like. For some reason, the camera was fooled into thinking that it's this sort of purplish color. So maybe what I actually want to do is to make it a little bit warmer. Now notice that we have a temperature slider in almost all of the raw processors that we have, and this allows us to modify the color temperature of an image. Now you'll notice that as we increase the color temperature, we're essentially making, and this is now matches what we expect, because as we increase the color temperature here, we're saying that we want to make the image a bit warmer. So here I can make the image warmer, as you can see, and by modifying the tint you can also get rid of some of the green or purple. So whereas the color temperature will add will make the image either warmer or cooler in terms of like this red to blue, you might want to modify also the tint, which modifies this other axis, green to purple, which is sort of this other concept as well. So we can try to add some additional green, which actually existed in this scene. And I'm telling you right now that this projector cannot reproduce colors for its life, because this was about the thing that looked right, and it looks like it's a mess, but there's a little patch of green that you can see here that's supposed to be grass, and it's about correct. So let's give another example. I can't see what these are, so I'm just going to pick this one at random. Let's see. No, that's too similar to what we already saw. How about this one? Okay, so here this is a photo at night, and night can wreak all sorts of havoc on auto white balance calculations as well. So what we might want to do is modify it maybe to make the image a little bit warmer, and really this goes a lot based on your perception of the image. You can try to make it a little bit warmer, to make it a little bit cooler, and sometimes that will make your image look really horrendous and really bad, but sometimes modifying the color temperature can be a really interesting thing for your image. So if I make it a little bit warmer, that's not really what I want. Maybe cooler is the direction that I actually want to go in the case of this image. Make the colors a little bit more neutral, whereas before what we saw was this sort of, this light right here was just a little bit too warm for this scene. Had I taken this photo with a white card, I would have a way of setting the white balance. But in this case, I don't. Now, you can use the sliders manually, but one of the things that I would recommend that you do is to actually use the spot tool, or the white balance tool. It's called different things depending on which software you're using. So this little eyedropper up there, and what you can do is you should select a portion of the image that's either completely white or what you know should be a very neutral gray. So if you click on any aspect of the image that has a tint to it at all, you're going to get a tint in the image. But what you're doing is you're telling the computer that you want the white balance to be set to whatever happens to be under that mouse. So right here I'm going to say, okay, well, maybe I'll try setting the white balance to the actual output from the lights that are above, and maybe we'll see what this looks like. Now realize that in this image, we're actually mixing a lot of different light sources. There's the lights coming from down here. There were a couple of flash units that were off to the side over here. And all of these are giving off different color temperatures, so this might not be the best thing. Now, the reason that this failed, and in fact, one of the reasons that I recommend not ever clicking on the light source itself, is that the colors that we're seeing in the scene are not generally from that, but rather from the reflections from everything else in the scene. So really what you want is the reflected light rather than the incident light. So maybe one of these gray tiles that are down here will produce a much better result, as you can see here. Now, if I thought that my flash unit was actually the predominant light source in this case, then I might instead choose something closer to where my flash unit was firing. So maybe like the white portion of the license plate here, for example. But as you know, as I mentioned before, the flash is not really the predominant light source, and we would just be providing this sort of color cast to this area image. But also, we also have the problem of the car has some lights as well that are providing yet another light source that could be confusing this issue. So if you have a very complicated light setup, and first of all, you should try to avoid that. If you have a whole bunch of lights that are giving off different color temperatures, generally you will have a hard time getting a good color result out of that. Excuse me. But if it's unavoidable, then the next best thing is to use a white card and take a picture of that, so you just have an overall knowledge of what white should be in this scene. But even just finding something in the image that's a neutral gray tends to be sufficient. But be very careful. If you have a very noisy image, this can also produce some artifacts as well, because maybe you have some chromatic noise that might throw off some of the effect here as well. So this is all sort of an important thing to weigh when talking about images. Now, this really allows us to round out our discussion about RAW versus JPEG, whereas before, at the very beginning of the semester, I just had to wave my hands and say, okay, you're just going to have to take for granted that using RAW allows you much more flexibility, allows you much more power than using JPEG. But now we've sort of talked about pretty much all of these things, how we can provide many more bits at each pixel in a RAW. So we just have much more information available to us to begin with. Then the tone curve is not applied, so that we can specify which stops of information are the most important to us in this image. The white balance, like we've just seen just now, can now be reset. And doing this same, you can adjust the colors a little bit. You can adjust the color tone in a JPEG file. But it's more difficult, and it's really risky to do, because you might get some posterization effects, you might clip some colors, you might do any number of bad things to your JPEG file, because the white balance has already been set in that JPEG file. Similarly, we've talked about compression, portability, all of these things. Even though we have this additional downside of having to post-process all of our RAW files, and we have this additional downside of a RAW file taking up that much more space on our hard drive and on our memory cards, and causing the camera to take fewer images per second or to fill up its buffer more quickly, it sort of is outweighed by all of this power that we have available to us. There's all of this complexity that's involved with color, but it really boils down to having these color spaces that are applied to images and color profiles that are applied to output devices. And in fact, one of the things that I didn't get to show you was this website, which I highly recommend. You can find it off the resources page. We don't have a lot of time to get into this, but this really shows us the difference between color management properly. Color managed software and improperly color managed software. To be clear, many web browsers that are in use in the internet today do not. In fact, they completely ignore whatever color space information happens to be inside of a JPEG. And so if you use Firefox, the latest version of Firefox, or you use Safari, you're probably going to be okay. But for the longest time, the only web browser that did proper color management was Safari. And so if you looked at an image that was tagged with Adobe RGB in Internet Explorer, for example, you were not looking at the image in the correct way. And on this webpage, they make this very clear, because they show you how you can use a color profile to completely and drastically change how one color looks on a screen. So for example, we have this right here, which is a tagged image that shows, you know, that has labels for each of these colors. But the original image, if we remove the tag, actually looks like this. So we have these values where we have 255 for blue, 0 for red, 0 for green, and just by using a color space, we're saying that that value represents the actual color red. This is an extreme example, but this shows us how using tagging allows us to properly identify and properly display these colors. In a browser that's not color managed, this would appear all the time. You would actually see this improperly colored image all of the time because it's not interpreting the embedded image tag that exists. In fact, you can actually use this to test your own web browser and see if you're actually viewing images on the web as they are meant to be seen, to see if your web browser is actually throwing away, ignoring the color space information that exists in this image that tells your computer how to interpret the colors and how to actually display them. So I highly recommend taking a look at this because this really nails, I think, the idea of why color management is important and how improperly color managing your software or your display can actually be quite a bad thing. And so with that, we've talked about color, and I look forward to seeing you again next week. Thank you all for coming.